She dropped both rocks on the caveman boyfriend at the same time. It blew his wheels, and he came after her with a gun. She disarmed him. She says it was the major turning point of her life. She told me she always knew she was stronger and more agile than he was. She knew it intellectually, but it took doing it to put it in her guts. "You saying she hates men?" Stu asked, looking at Sue closely. Susan shook her head. "She's bi now."
"Bi now?"
Stu said doubtfully. "She's happy with either sex, Stuart. And I hope you're not going to start leaning on the committee to institute the blue laws along with thou shalt not kill." "I got enough to worry about without getting into who sleeps with who," he mumbled, and they all laughed. "I only asked because I don't want anyone going into this thing as a crusade. We need eyes over there, not guerrilla fighters. This is a job for a weasel, not a lion."
"She knows that," Susan said. "Fran asked me how she took it when I asked her if she'd go over there for us. She took it very well. For one thing, she reminded me that if we'd stayed with those men..."
"Remember how you found us, Stu?" He nodded.
"If we'd stayed with them, we would have either wound up dead or in the West anyway, because that's the direction they were going in, at least when they were sober enough to read the road signs. She said she'd been wondering what her place in the zone was and guessed that her place in the zone was out of it. And she said..."
"What?" Fran asked.
"That she'd try to come back," Sue said rather abruptly, and said no more.
What else Dana Jurgens had said was between the two of them, something not even the other members of the committee were to know. Dana was going west with a 10-inch switchblade strapped to her arm and a spring-loaded clip. When she bent her wrist sharply, the spring unloaded, and hey presto, she had suddenly grown a sixth finger, one which was 10 inches long and double-bladed. She felt that most of them, the men, would not have understood.
"If he's a big enough dictator, then maybe he's all that's holding them together. If he was gone, maybe they'd start fighting and squabbling among themselves. It might be the end of them if he dies. And if I get close to him, Susie, he better have his guardian devil with him."
"They'll kill you, Dana."
"Maybe, maybe not. It might be worth it just to have the pleasure of watching his guts fall out on the floor."
Susan could have stopped her, maybe, but she hadn't tried. She had contented herself with extracting a promise from Dana that she would stick to the original script unless a near-perfect opportunity came up. To that, Dana had agreed, and Sue didn't think her friend would get that chance. Flag would be well guarded. Still, in the 3 days since she had broached the idea of going west as a spy to her friend, Sue Stern had found it very difficult to sleep. "Well," she said to the rest of them now, "I'm home to bed. Night, folks." She walked off, hands in the pockets of her fatigue jacket.
"She looks older," Stu said.
Nick wrote and offered the open pad to both of them. "We all do," was written there. Stu was on his way up to the power station the next morning when he saw Susan and Dana headed down Canyon Boulevard on a pair of cycles. He waved, and they pulled over. He thought he had never seen Dana looking prettier. Her hair was tied behind her with a bright green silk scarf, and she was wearing a rawhide coat open over jeans and a chambray shirt. A bedroll was strapped on behind her.
"Stuart!" she cried, and waved to him, smiling.
"Lesbian?" he thought doubtfully.
"I understand you're off on a little trip," he said.
"For sure, and you never saw me."
"Nope," Stu said. "Never did. Smoke?"
Dana took a Marlboro and cupped her hands over his match.
"You be careful, girl."
"I will."
"And get back."
"I hope to."
They looked at each other in the bright late summer morning.
"You take care of Franny, big fella."
"I will."
"And go easy on the marshalin'."
"That I know I can do."
She cast the cigarette away.
"What do you say, Suze?"
Susan nodded and put her bike in gear, smiling a strained smile.
"Dana?"
She looked at him, and Stu planted a soft kiss on her mouth.
"Good luck."
She smiled.
"You have to do it twice for really good luck, didn't you know that?"
He kissed her again, more slowly and thoroughly this time.
"Lesbian?"
he wondered again.
"Franny's a lucky woman," Dana said,
"and you can quote me."
Smiling, not really knowing what to say, Sue stepped back and said nothing at all.
Two blocks up, one of the lumbering orange burial committee trucks rumbled through the intersection like an omen, and the moment was broken.
"Let's go, kid," Dana said. "Get 'em up, Scout."
They drove off, and Stu stood on the curbing and watched them. Sue Stern was back 2 days later. She had watched Dana moving west from Colorado Springs, she said, had watched her until she was nothing but a speck that merged with the great still landscape. Then she had cried a little. The first night Sue had made camp at Monument and had awakened in the small hours, chilled by a low whining sound that seemed to be coming from a culvert that traveled beneath the farm road she had camped by. Finally summoning up her courage, she had shined her flash into the corrugated pipe and had discovered a gaunt and shivering puppy. It looked to be about 6 months old. It shied from her touch, and she was too big to crawl into the pipe. At last she had gone into the town of Monument, smashed her way into the local grocery, and had come back in the first cold light of false dawn with a knapsack full of Alpo and Cycle One. That did the trick. The puppy rode back with her, neatly tucked into one of the BSA saddlebags. Dick Ellis went into raptures over the puppy. It was an Irish setter bitch, either purebred or so close as to make no difference. When she got older, he was sure Kojak would be glad to make her acquaintance. The news swept the Free Zone, and for that day the subject of Mother Abigail was forgotten in the excitement over the canine Adam and Eve. Susan Stern became something of a heroine, and as far as any of the committee ever knew, no one even thought to wonder what she had been doing in Monument that night, far south of Boulder. But it was the morning the two of them left Boulder that Stu remembered, watching them ride off toward the Denver-Boulder Turnpike. Because no one in the zone ever saw Dana Juergens again. August 27th. Nearly dusk. Venus shining against the sky. Nick, Ralph, Larry, and Stu sat on the steps of Tom Cullen's house. Tom was on the lawn, whooping and knocking croquet balls through a set of wickets. "It's time," Nick wrote. Speaking low, Stu asked if they would have to hypnotize him again, and Nick shook his head.
"Good," Ralph said. "I don't think I could take that action."
Raising his voice, he called, "Tom? Hey, Tommy, come on over here." Tom came running over, grinning.
"Tommy, it's time to go," Ralph said.
Tom's smile faltered. For the first time, he seemed to notice that it was getting dark.
"Go? Now, laws no, when it gets dark, Tom goes to bed. M-O-O-N, that spells bed. Tom doesn't like to be out after dark because of the boogies. Tom...
He fell silent, and the others looked at him uneasily. Tom had lapsed into dull silence. He came out of it, but not in the usual way. It was not a sudden reanimation, life flooding back in a rush, but a slow thing, reluctant, almost sad.
"Go west?" he said. "Do you mean it's that time?"
Stu laid a hand on his shoulder.
"Yes, Tom, if you can." "On the road."
Ralph made a choked, muttering sound and walked around the house. Tom did not seem to notice. His gaze alternated between Stu and Nick.
"Travel at night. Sleep in the day."
Very slowly, in the dusk, Tom added,
"And see the elephant."
Nick nodded. Larry brought Tom's pack up from where it had rested beside the steps. Tom put it on slowly, dreamily.
"You want to be careful, Tom," Larry said thickly.
"Careful? Laws, yes."
Stu wondered belatedly if they should have given Tom a one-man tent as well, and rejected it. Tom would get all bollocksed up trying to set up even a little tent.
"Nick," Tom whispered, "do I really have to do this?"
Nick put an arm around Tom and nodded slowly.
"All right."
"Just stay on the big four-lane highway, Tom," Larry said. "The one that says 70.
Ralph is going to drive you down to the start of it on his motorcycle.
Yes, Ralph.
He paused. Ralph had come back around the house. He was swabbing at his eyes with his bandana.
You ready, Tom? He asked gruffly.
Nick, will it still be my house when I get back?
Nick nodded vigorously.
Tom loves his house. Laws, yes.
We know you do, Tommy.
Stu could feel warm tears in the back of his own throat now.
All right, I'm ready. Who am I riding with?
Me, Tom, Ralph said. Down to Route 70, remember?
Tom nodded and began to walk toward Ralph's cycle. After a moment, Ralph followed him, his big shoulders slumped. Even the feather in his hatband seemed dejected. He climbed on the bike and kicked it alive. A moment later, it pulled out onto Broadway and turned east. They stood together, watching the motorcycle dwindle to a moving silhouette in the purple dusk, marked by a moving headlight. Then the light disappeared behind the bulk of the Holiday Twin Drive-In and was gone. Nick walked away, head down, hands in pockets. Stu tried to join him, but Nick shook his head almost angrily and motioned him away. Stu went back to Larry.
That's that, Larry said, and Stu nodded gloomily.
You think we'll ever see him again, Larry?
If we don't, the seven of us, well, maybe not Fran, she was never for sending him. The rest of us are going to be eating and sleeping with the decision to send him for the rest of our lives.
Nick more than anyone else, Stu said.
Yeah, Nick more than anyone else. They watched Nick walking slowly down Broadway, losing himself in the shadows which grew around him. Then they looked at Tom's darkened house in silence for a minute.
Let's get out of here, Larry said suddenly. The thought of all those stuffed animals. All of a sudden I got a grade-A case of the creeps.
When they left, Nick was still standing on the side lawn of Tom Collins' house, his hands in his pockets, his head down. George Richardson, the new doctor, had set up in the Dakota Ridge Medical Center because it was close to Boulder City Hospital with its medical equipment, its large supplies of drugs, and its operating rooms. By August 28th, he was pretty much in business, assisted by Laurie Constable and Dick Ellis. Dick had asked leave to quit the world of medicine and had been refused permission to do so.
You're doing a fine job here, Richardson said. You've learned a lot and you're going to learn more. Besides, there's just too much for me to do by myself. We're going to be out of our minds as it is if we don't get another doctor in a month or two. So, congratulations, Dick. You're the zone's first paramedic. Give him a kiss, Laurie.
Laurie did. Around 11 o'clock on that late August morning, Fran let herself into the waiting room and looked around curiously and a little nervously. Laurie was behind the counter, reading an old copy of the Ladies' Home Journal.
"Hi, Fran," she said, jumping up. "I thought we'd see you sooner or later. George is with Candy Jones right now, but he'll be right with you. How are you feeling?"
"Pretty well, thanks," Fran said. "I guess..."
The door to one of the examining rooms opened, and Candy Jones came out, following a tall, stooped man in corduroy slacks and a sport shirt with the Izod alligator on the breast. Candy was looking doubtfully at a bottle of pink stuff, which she held in one hand.
"Are you sure that's what it is?" she asked Richardson doubtfully. "I never got it before. I thought I was immune."
"Well, you're not, and you have it now," George said with a grin. "Don't forget the starch baths and stay out of the tall grass after this."
She smiled ruefully.
"Jack's got it, too. Should he come in?"
"No, but you can make the starch baths a family affair."
Candy nodded dolefully and then spotted Fran.
"Hi, Franny. How's the girl?"
"Okay. How's by you?"
"Terrible."
Candy held up the bottle so Fran could read the word Caladryl on the label.
"Poison ivy, and you couldn't guess where I got it."
She brightened.
"But I bet you can guess where Jack's got it."
They watched her go with some amusement. Then George said, "Miss Goldsmith, isn't it? Free Zone Committee? A pleasure." She held out her hand to be shaken.
"Just Fran, please. Or Franny."
"Okay, Franny. What's the problem?"
"I'm pregnant," Fran said, "and pretty damn scared."
and then, with no warning at all, she was in tears. George put an arm around her shoulders.
"Lori, I'll want you in about 5 minutes."
"All right, doctor."
He led her into the examining room and had her sit on the black upholstered table. "Now, why the tears? Is it Mrs. Wentworth's twins?"
Franny nodded miserably.
"It was a difficult delivery, Fran. The mother was a heavy smoker. The babies were lightweights, even for twins. They came in the late evening very suddenly. I had no opportunity to make a post-mortem. Regina Wentworth is being cared for by some of the women who are in our party. I believe, I hope she's going to come out of the mental fugue state she's currently in. But for now, all I can say is that those babies had two strikes against them from the start. The cause of death could have been anything."
"Including the superflu?"
"Yes, including that."
"So we just wait and see?"
"Hell no. I'm going to give you a complete prenatal right now. I'm going to monitor you and any other woman that gets pregnant or is pregnant now every step of the way. General Electric used to have a slogan, 'Progress is our most important product.' In the zone, babies are our most important product, and they are going to be treated accordingly."
"But we really don't know."
"No, we don't. But be of good cheer, Fran."
"Yes, all right, I'll try."
There was a brief rap at the door, and Lori came in. She handed George a form on a clipboard, and George began to ask Fran questions about her medical history. When the exam was over, George left her for a while to do something in the next room. Lori stayed with her while Fran dressed. As she was buttoning her blouse, Lori said quietly,
"I envy you, you know, uncertainty and all. Dick and I had been trying to make a baby like mad. It's really funny. I was the one who used to wear a zero population button to work. It meant zero population growth, of course, but when I think about that button now, it gives me a really creepy feeling. Oh, Franny, yours is going to be the first, and I know it will be all right. It has to be."
Fran only smiled and nodded, not wanting to remind Lori that hers would not be the first. Mrs. Wentworth's twins had been the first, and Mrs. Wentworth's twins had died. "Fine," George said half an hour later. Fran raised her eyebrows, thinking for a moment he had mispronounced her name. For no good reason, she remembered that until the third grade, little Mikey Post from down the street had called her Fan. "The baby. It's fine." Fran found a Kleenex and held it tightly.
"I felt it move, but that was some time ago. Nothing since then. I was afraid..."
"It's alive, all right, but I really doubt if you felt it move, you know. More like a little intestinal gas."
"It was the baby," Fran said quietly.
"Well, whether it did or not, it's going to move a lot in the future. I've got you pegged for early to mid-January. How does that sound?"
"Fine."
"Are you eating right?"
"Yes, I think so. Trying hard, anyway."
"Good. No nausea now?"
"A little at first, but it's passed."
"Lovely. Getting plenty of exercise?"
For a nightmare instant, she saw herself digging her father's grave. She blinked the vision away. That had been another life. "Yes, plenty."
"Have you gained any weight?"
"About 5 pounds.
"That's all right. You can have another 12. I'm feeling generous today."
She grinned. "You're the doctor."
"Yes, and I used to be an OB man, so you're in the right place. Take your doctor's advice and you'll go far. Now, concerning bicycles, motorbikes and mopeds, all of them a no-no after November 15th, let's say. No one's going to be riding them by then anyway. Too damn cold. Don't smoke or drink to excess, do you?"
"No."
"If you want a nightcap once in a while, I think that's perfectly okay. I'm going to put you on a vitamin supplement. You can pick it up at any drugstore in town."
Franny burst into laughter, and George smiled uncertainly.
"Did I say something funny?"
"No. It just came out funny under the circumstances."
"Oh, yes, I see. Well, at least there won't be any more complaining about high drug prices, will there? One last thing, Fran. Have you ever been fitted with an intrauterine device, an IUD?"
"No, why?" Fran asked.
Then she happened to think of her dream, the dark man with his coat hanger. She shuddered.
"No," she said again.
"Good. That's it."
He stood up.
I won't tell you not to worry.
No, she agreed. The laughter was gone from her eyes. Don't do that.
But I will ask you to keep it to a minimum. Excess anxiety in the mother can lead to glandular imbalance, and that's not good for the baby. I don't like to prescribe tranquilizers for pregnant women, but if you think...
No, that won't be necessary, Fran said.
But going out into the hot midday sunshine, she knew that the entire second half of her pregnancy was going to be haunted by thoughts of Mrs. Wentworth's vanished twins. On the 29th of August, three groups came in, one with 22 members, one with 16, and one with 25. Sandy Duchenne got around to see all seven members of the committee and tell them that the Free Zone now had over 1,000 residents. Boulder no longer seemed such a ghost town. On the evening of the 30th, Nadine Cross stood in the basement of Harold's house, watching him and feeling uneasy. When Harold was doing something that didn't involve having some sort of strange sex with her, he seemed to go away to his own private place where she had no control over him. When he was in that place, he seemed cold. More than that, he seemed contemptuous of her and even of himself. The only thing that didn't change was his hate of Stuart Redman and the others on the committee. There was a dead air hockey game in the basement, and Harold was working on its pinholed surface. There was an open book beside him. On the facing page was a diagram. He would look at the diagram for a while, then look at the apparatus he was working on, and then he would do something to it. Spread out neatly by his right hand were the tools from his Triumph motorcycle kit. Little snips of wire littered the air hockey table. "You know," he said absently, "you want to take a walk."
"Why?"
She felt a trifle hurt. Harold's face was tense and unsmiling. Nadine could understand why Harold smiled as much as he did, because when he stopped, he looked insane. She suspected that he was insane, or very nearly.
"Because I don't know how old this dynamite is," Harold said.
"What do you mean?"
"Old dynamite sweats, dear heart," he said, and looked up at her. She saw that his entire face was running with sweat, as if to prove his point.
"It perspires, to be perfectly couth. And what it perspires is pure nitroglycerin, one of the world's great unstable substances. So if it's old, there's a very good chance that this little science fair project could blow us right over the top of Flagstaff Mountain and all the way to the Land of Oz."
"Well, you don't have to sound so snotty about it," Nadine said.
"Nadine, ma chère."
"What?"
Harold looked at her calmly and without smiling.
"Shut your fucking trap."
She did, but she didn't take a walk, although she wanted to. Surely if this was Flagg's will, and the planchette had told her that Harold was Flagg's way of taking care of the committee, the dynamite wouldn't be old. And even if it was old, it wouldn't explode until it was supposed to, would it? Just how much control over events did Flagg have? "Enough," she told herself. "He has enough." But she wasn't sure, and she was increasingly uneasy. She had been back to her house and Joe was gone, gone for good this time. She had gone to see Lucy and had borne the cold reception long enough to learn that since she had moved in with Harold, Joe, Lucy of course called him Leo, had slipped back some. Lucy obviously blamed her for that too, but if an avalanche came rumbling down from Flagstaff Mountain or an earthquake ripped Pearl Street apart, Lucy would probably blame her for those things too. Not that there wouldn't be enough to blame on her and Harold very soon. Still, she had been bitterly disappointed not to have seen Joe once more, to kiss him goodbye. She and Harold were not going to be in the Boulder Free Zone much longer. "Never mind. Best you let him go completely now that you're embarked on this obscenity. You'd only be doing him harm, and possibly harm to yourself as well, because Joe sees things, knows things. Let him stop being Joe. Let me stop being Nadine, Mom. Let him go back to being Leo forever." But the paradox in that was inexorable. She could not believe that any of these zone people had more than a year's life left in them, and that included the boy. It was not his will that they should live. "So tell the truth. It isn't just Harold who is his instrument. It's you, too. You,
who once defined the single unforgivable sin in the post-plague world as murder, as the taking of a single life. Suddenly she found herself wishing that the dynamite was old, that it would blow up and put an end to both of them, a merciful end. And then she found herself thinking about what would happen afterward, after they had gotten over the mountains, and felt the old slippery warmth kindle in her belly. "There," Harold said gently. He had lowered his apparatus into a hush puppy's shoebox and set it aside. "It's done?"
"Yes, done."
"Will it work? Would you like to try it and find out?" His words were bitterly sarcastic, but she didn't mind. His eyes were working her over in that greedy, crawling little boy's way that she had come to recognize. He had returned from that distant place, the place from which she had written what was in the ledger that she had read and then replaced carelessly under the loose hearthstone where it had originally been. Now she could handle him. Now his talk was just talk. "Would you like to watch me play with myself first?" she asked. "Like last night?" "Yeah," he said. "Okay, good." "Let's go upstairs, then." She batted her eyelashes at him. "I'll go first." "Yeah," he said hoarsely. Little dots of sweat stood out on his brow, but fear hadn't put them there this time. "Go first." So she went up first, and she could feel him looking up the short skirt of the little girl sailor dress she was wearing. She was bare beneath it. The door closed, and the thing that Harold had made sat in the open shoebox in the gloom. There was a battery-powered, realistic walkie-talkie handset from Radio Shack. Its back was off. Wired to it were 8 sticks of dynamite. The book was still open. It was from the Boulder Public Library, and the title was 65 National Science Fair Prize Winners. The diagram showed a doorbell wired up to a walkie-talkie similar to the one in the shoebox. The caption beneath said, "Third Prize, 1977 National Science Fair, constructed by Brian Ball, Rutland, Vermont. Say the word and ring the bell up to 12 miles away." Some hours later that evening, Harold came back downstairs, put the cover on the shoebox, and carried it carefully upstairs. He put it on the top shelf of a kitchen cupboard. Ralph Brentner had told him that afternoon that the Free Zone Committee was inviting Chad Norris to speak at their next meeting. "When was that going to be?" Harold had inquired casually. "September 2nd, Ralph had said. September 2nd. Chapter 57. Larry and Leo were sitting on the curb in front of the house. Larry was drinking a warm Ham's beer, Leo a warm orange spot. You could have anything to drink in Boulder that you wanted these days, as long as it came in a can and you didn't mind drinking it warm. From out back came the steady, gruff roar of the lawn boy. Lucy was cutting the grass. Larry had offered to do it, but Lucy shook her head. "Find out what's wrong with Leo, if you can." It was the last day of August. The day after Nadine had moved in with Harold, Leo hadn't appeared for breakfast. Larry had found the boy in his room, dressed only in his underpants, his thumb in his mouth. He was uncommunicative and hostile. Larry had been more frightened than Lucy because she didn't know how Leo had been when Larry had first encountered him. His name had been Joe then, and he had been brandishing a killer's knife. The best part of a week had passed since then, and Leo was a little better, but he hadn't come back all the way, and he wouldn't talk about what had happened. "That woman has something to do with it," Lucy had said, screwing the cap onto the lawnmower's tank.
"Nadine? What makes you think that?"
"Well, I wasn't going to mention it, but she came by the other day while you and Leo were trying the fishing down a cold creek. She wanted to see the boy. I was just as glad the two of you were gone."
"Lucy," she gave him a quick kiss, and he had slipped his hand under her halter and given her a friendly squeeze.
"I judged you wrong before," she said. "I guess I'll always be sorry for that. But I'm never going to like Nadine Cross. There's something wrong with her."
Larry didn't answer, but he thought Lucy's judgment was probably a true one. That night up by King Super's, she had been like a crazy woman.
There's one other thing. When she was here, she didn't call him Leo. She called him the other name, Joe.
He looked at her blankly as she turned the automatic starter and got the lawn boy going. Now, half an hour after that discussion, he drank his hams and watched Leo bounce the ping-pong ball he had found the day the two of them had walked up to Harold's, where Nadine now lived. The small white ball was smudged, but not dented. Thock, 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 against the pavement. Bouncy, bouncy ball-y, look at the way we play. Leo, he was Leo now, wasn't he? Hadn't wanted to go inside Harold's house that day. Into the house where Nadine Mom was now living.
"You want to go fishing, kiddo?" Larry offered suddenly.
"No fish," Leo said. He looked at Larry with his strange seawater green eyes.
"Do you know Mr. Ellis?"
"Sure.
He says we can drink the water when the fish come back. Drink it without..."
He made a hooting noise and waved his fingers in front of his eyes.
"You know."
"Without boiling it?"
"Yes."
Thock, thock, thock.
"I like Dick. Him and Lori always give me something to eat. He's afraid they won't be able to, but I think they will."
"Will what?"
"Be able to make a baby. Dick thinks he may be too old, but I guess he's not."
Larry started to ask how Leo and Dick had gotten on that subject, and then didn't. The answer, of course, was that they hadn't. Dick wouldn't talk to a small boy about something so personal as making a baby. Leo had just known. Thock, thock, thock. Yes, Leo knew things, or intuited them. He hadn't wanted to go in Harold's house, and had said something about Nadine, he couldn't remember exactly what. But Larry had recalled that discussion, and had felt very uneasy when he heard that Nadine had moved in with Harold. It had been as if the boy was in a trance, as if... Thock, thock, thock. Larry watched the ping-pong ball bounce up and down, and suddenly he looked into Leo's face. The boy's eyes were dark and far away. The sound of the lawnmower was a far-off, soporific drone. The daylight was smooth and warm, and Leo was in a trance again, as if he had read Larry's thought and simply responded to it. Leo had gone to see the elephant. Very casually, Larry said, "Yes, I think they can make a baby. Dick can't be any more than 55 at the outside. Cary Grant made one when he was almost 70, I believe."
"Who's Cary Grant?" Leo asked.
The ball went up and down, up and down.
"Notorious. North by Northwest."
"Don't you know?" he asked Leo.
"He was that actor," Leo said. "He was in Notorious and Northwest."
"North by Northwest."
"North by Northwest, I mean," Leo said in a tone of agreement.
His eyes never left the ping-pong ball's bouncing course.
"That's right," he said. "How's Nadine Mom, Leo?"
"She calls me Joe. I'm Joe to her."
"Oh."
A cold chill was weaving its slow way up Larry's back.
"It's bad now."
"Bad?"
"It's bad with both of them."
"Nadine and..."
"Harold?"
"Yes, him."
"They're not happy?"
"He's got them fooled. They think he wants them."
"He?"
"Him."
The word hung on the still summer air. Thock, thock, thock.
"They're going to go west," Leo said.
"Jesus," Larry muttered.
He was very cold now. The old fear swept him. Did he really want to hear any more of this? It was like watching a tomb door swing slowly open in a silent graveyard, seeing a hand emerge.
"Whatever it is, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know it."
"Nadine Mom wants to think it's your fault," Leo said. "She wants to think you drove her to Harold. But she waited on purpose. She waited until you loved Lucy Mom too much. She waited until she was sure. It's like he's rubbing away the part of her brain that knows right from wrong. Little by little, he's rubbing that part away. And when it's gone, she'll be as crazy as everyone else in the West. Crazier, maybe.
Leo,
Larry whispered, and Leo answered immediately. She calls me Joe. I'm Joe to her.
Shall I call you Joe?
Larry asked doubtfully.
No.
There was a note of pleading in the boy's voice.
No, please don't.
You miss your Nadine, Mom, don't you, Leo?
She's dead,
Leo said with chilling simplicity.
Is that why you stayed out so late that night?
Yes.
And why you wouldn't talk?
Yes.
But you're talking now.
I have you and Lucy, Mom, to talk to.
Yes, of course, but not for always, the boy said fiercely.
Not for always, unless you talk to Franny. Talk to Franny. Talk to Franny.
About Nadine?
No.
About what? About you?
Leo's voice rose, became even shriller.
It's all written down. You know, Franny knows. Talk to Franny.
The committee?
Not the committee. The committee won't help you. It won't help anyone. The committee is the old way. He laughs at your committee because it's the old way, and the old ways are his ways. You know, Franny knows. If you talk together, you can...
Leo brought the ball down hard. Thock. And it rose higher than his head and came down and rolled away. Larry watched it, his mouth dry, his heart thudding nastily in his chest.
I dropped my ball, Leo said, and ran to get it.
Larry sat watching him.
Franny, he thought.
The two of them sat on the edge of the bandshell stage, their feet dangling. It was an hour before dark, and a few people were walking through the park, some of them holding hands. The children's hour is also the lover's hour, Fran thought disjointedly. Larry had just finished telling her everything Leo had said in his trance, and her mind was whirling with it.
So what do you think? Larry asked.
I don't know what to think, she said softly, except I don't like any of the things that have been happening. Visionary dreams, an old woman who's the voice of God for a while and then walks off into the wilderness. Now a little boy who seems to be a telepath. It's like life in a fairy tale. Sometimes I think the superflu left us alive but drove us all mad.
He said I should talk to you, so I am.
She didn't reply.
Well, Larry said, if anything comes to you...
Written down, Franny said softly.
He was right, that kid. It's the whole root of the problem, I think. If I hadn't been so stupid, so conceited as to write it all down... Oh, goddamn me!
Larry stared at her, amazed.
What are you talking about?
It's Harold, she said, and I'm afraid. I haven't told Stu. I've been ashamed. Keeping the diary was so dumb. And now Stu, he actually likes Harold. Everybody in the Free Zone likes Harold, including you.
She uttered a laugh which was choked with tears.
After all, he was your spirit guide on the way out here, wasn't he?
I'm not tracking this very well, Larry said slowly. Can you tell me what it is you're afraid of?
That's just it. I don't really know.
She looked at him, her eyes wet with tears.
I think I'd better tell you what I can, Larry. I have to talk to someone. God knows I just can't keep it inside anymore, and Stu's maybe not the person who should hear. At least not the first one.
Go ahead, Fran, shoot.
So she told him, beginning with the day in June that Harold had driven into the driveway of her Ogunquit home in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac. As she talked, the last bright daylight changed to a bluish shade. The lovers in the park began to drift away. A thin rind of moon rose. In the high-rise condominium on the far side of Canyon Boulevard, a few Coleman gas lamps had come on. She told him about the sign on the barn roof and how she had been sleeping when Harold risked his life to put her name on the bottom. About meeting Stu and Fabian,
about Harold's shrill get-away-from-my-bone reaction to Stew. She told him about her diary and about the thumbprint in it. By the time she finished, it was past 9 o'clock and the crickets were singing. A silence fell between them, and Fran waited apprehensively for Larry to break it. But he seemed lost in thought. At last he said, "How sure are you about that fingerprint? In your own mind, are you positive it was Harold's?" She only hesitated a moment. "Yes, I knew it was Harold's print the first time I saw it." "That barn he put the sign on," Larry said. "You remember the night I met you, I said I'd been up in it, and that Harold had carved his initials on a beam in the loft?"
"Yes."
"It wasn't just his initials. It was yours, too, in a heart. The kind of thing a lovesick little boy would do on his school desk." She put her hands over her eyes and wiped them.
"What a mess," she said huskily.
"You're not responsible for Harold Lauder's actions, Keed." He took her hand in both of his and held it tightly. He looked at her. "Take it from me, the original dipstick, oil slick, and drippy dick. You can't hold it against yourself. Because if you do..." His grip tightened to a degree where it became painful, but his face remained soft. "If you do, you really will go mad. It's hard enough for a person to keep their own socks pulled up, let alone someone else's." He took his hand away, and they were quiet for a time. "You think Harold bears Stew a killing grudge?" he said at last. "You really think it's that deep?"
"Yes," she said.
"I really think that's a possibility. Maybe the whole committee, but I don't know what..." His hand fell on her shoulder and gripped it hard, stilling her. In the darkness, his posture had changed. His eyes had widened. His lips moved soundlessly.
"Larry? What..."
"When he went downstairs," Larry muttered. "He went down to get a corkscrew or something."
"What?"
He turned toward her softly, as if his head was on a rusty hinge. "You know," he said, "there just might be a way to resolve all this. I don't guarantee it because I didn't look in the book, but it makes such beautiful sense. Harold reads your diary and not only gets an earful, but an idea. Hell, he might have even been jealous that you thought of it first. Didn't all the best writers keep journals?"
"Are you saying Harold's got a diary?"
"When he went down to the basement the day I brought the wine, I was looking around his living room. He said he was going to put in some chrome and leather, and I was trying to figure out how it would look. And I noticed this loose stone on the hearth."
"Yes!"
she yelled, so loudly that he jumped.
"The day I snuck in, and Nadine Cross came, I sat on the hearth. I remember that loose stone."
She looked at Larry again.
"There it is again, as if something had us by the nose, was leading us to it."
"Coincidence," he said, but he sounded uneasy.
"Is it? We were both in Harold's house. We both noticed the loose stone. And we're both here now. Is it coincidence?"
"I don't know."
"What was under that stone?"
"A ledger," he said slowly. "At least, that was the word stamped on the cover. I didn't look in it. At the time, I thought it could just as easily have belonged to the previous owner of the house as to Harold. But if it did, wouldn't Harold have found it? We both noticed the loose stone. So, let's say he finds it. Even if the guy who lived there before the fluid filled it up with little secrets, the amount he cheated on his taxes, his sex fantasies about his daughter, I don't know what all, those secrets wouldn't have been Harold's secrets. Do you see that?"
"Yes, but don't interrupt while Inspector Underwood is elucidating, you giddy slip of a girl. So if the secrets weren't Harold's secrets, why would he have put the ledger back under the stone?"
"Because they were his secrets. That was Harold's journal."
"Do you think it's still there?"
"Maybe. I think we'd better look and see."
"Now?"
"Tomorrow. He'll be out with the burial committee, and Nadine has been helping out at the power station afternoons."
"All right," she said.
"Do you think I should tell Stew about this?"
"Why don't we wait?
There's no sense stirring things up unless we're sure it's something important. The book might be gone. It might be nothing but a list of things to do. It might be full of perfectly innocent things. Or Harold's master political plan.
or it might be in code. I hadn't thought of that. What will we do if there is something important? Then I guess we'll have to bring it up before the Free Zone Committee. Another reason to get it done quickly. We're meeting on the 2nd. The committee will handle it. Will it? Yes, I think so, Larry said. But he was also thinking of what Leo had said about the committee. She slipped off the edge of the bandshell and onto the ground. I feel better. Thanks for being here, Larry. Where should we meet? The little park across from Harold's. What about there, at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon? Fine, Larry said. I'll see you then. Franny went home feeling lighter at heart than she had for weeks. As Larry said, the alternatives were now fairly clear. The ledger might prove all of their fears groundless, but if it proved otherwise... Well, if it was otherwise, let the committee decide. As Larry had reminded her, they were meeting on the evening of the 2nd at Nick and Ralph's place, out near the end of Baseline Road. When she got home, Stu was sitting in the bedroom, a felt-tip marker in one hand and a weighty, leather-bound volume in the other. The title, stamped in gold leaf on the cover, was An Introduction to the Colorado Code of Criminal Justice. Heavy reading, she said, and kissed him on the mouth. Arg. He tossed the book across the room, and it landed on the dresser with a thump. Al Bundell brought it over. He and his law committee are really up and in the doings, Fran. He wants to talk to the Free Zone Committee when we meet day after tomorrow. What have you been up to, pretty lady? Talking with Larry Underwood. He looked at her closely for a long moment. Fran, have you been crying? Yes, she said, meeting his gaze steadily. But I feel much better now, much better. Is it the baby? No. What then? I'll tell you tomorrow night. I'll tell you everything that's been on what passes for my mind. Until then, no questions, okay? Is it serious? Stu, I don't know. He looked at her for a long, long time. All right, Franny, he said. I love you. I know, and I love you too. Bed? She smiled. Race you. The 1st of September dawned gray and rainy, a dull, forgettable day, but one that no resident of the Free Zone ever forgot. That was the day the power came back on in North Boulder, briefly at least. At 10 to noon in the control room of the power station, Brad Kitchener looked at Stu, Nick, Ralph, and Jack Jackson, who were all standing behind him. Brad smiled nervously and said, "Hail Mary, full of grace, help me win this stock car race." He yanked two big switches down hard. In the huge and cavernous hall below them, two trial generators began to whine. The five men walked over to the wall-to-wall polarized glass window and looked below, to where almost 100 men and women stood, all of them wearing protective goggles as per Brad's order. "If we did something wrong, I'd rather blow 2 than 52, Brad had told them earlier. The generators began to whine more loudly. Nick elbowed Stu and pointed to the office ceiling. Stu looked up and began to grin. Behind the translucent panels, the fluorescence had begun to glow weakly. The generators cycled up and up, reached a high, steady hum, and leveled off. Down below, the crowd of assembled workers broke into spontaneous applause, some of them wincing as they did so. Their hands were raw and frayed from wrapping copper wire hour after drudging hour. The fluorescents were shining brightly and normally now. For Nick, the feeling was the exact opposite of the dread he had known when the lights went out in Shoyo, not one of entombment now, but of resurrection. The two generators supplied power to one small section of North Boulder in the North Street area. There were people in the area who hadn't known about the test that morning, and many of these people fled as if all the devils of hell were after them. TV sets went on in blares of snow. In a house on Spruce Street, a blender whirred into life, trying to blend a cheese and egg mixture that had congealed long since. The blender's motor soon overloaded and blew out. A power saw whined into life in a deserted garage, puffing sawdust out of its guts. Stove burners began to glow.
Marvin Gaye began to sing from the loudspeakers of an oldies record shop called the Wax Museum. The words, backed by a jive disco beat, seemed like a dream of the past come to life. "Let's dance, let's shout, get funky what it's all about. Let's dance, let's shout." A power transformer blew on Maple Street, and a gaudy spiral of purple sparks drifted down, lit on the wet grass, and went out. At the power station, one of the generators began to whine at a higher, more desperate note. It began to smoke. People backed away, poised just below the point of panic. The place began to fill with the sickish sweet smell of ozone. A buzzer went off stridently.
"Too high!" Brad roared. "Bastards crossing over! Overloading!"
He scrambled across the room and slammed both switches back up. The whine of the generators began to die, but not before there was a loud pop and screams, deadened by the safety glass, from below.
"Holy crow," Ralph said. "One of 'em's afire."
Above them, the fluorescence faded to sullen cores of white light, then went out completely. Brad jerked open the control room door and came out on the landing. His words echoed flatly in the big open space.
"Get the foam to that! Hustle!"
Several foam extinguishers were turned on the generators, and the fire was doused. The smell of ozone still hung on the air. The others crowded out on the landing beside Brad. Stu laid a hand on his shoulder.
"I'm sorry it turned out the way it did, man," he said.
Brad turned toward him, grinning.
"Sorry, for what?"
"Well, it caught fire, didn't it?" Jack asked.
"Shit, yes, it surely did. And somewhere around North Street there's a transformer all blown to shit. We forgot, goddammit, we forgot. They got sick, they died, but they didn't go around turning off their electrical appliances before they did. There are TVs on and ovens and electric blankets all over Boulder. Hell of a power drain. These generators, they're built to cross over when the load's heavy in one place and light in another. That one down there tried to cross, but all the others were shut down, see?"
Brad was fairly jerking with excitement.
"Gary, you remember the way Gary, Indiana, was burned to the ground?"
They nodded.
"Can't be sure, we'll never be sure, but what happened here could have happened there. Could be the power didn't go off soon enough. One shorted-out electric blanket could have been enough under the right conditions, just like Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicking over that lantern in Chicago. These Jennies tried to cross and had nothing to cross to, so they burned out. We're lucky it happened, that's what I think. Take my word for it."
"If you say so," Ralph responded doubtfully.
Brad said, "We've got the job to do all over again, but only on one motor. We'll be in business, but—"
Brad had begun to snap his fingers, an unconscious gesture of excitement.
"We don't dare turn the juice back on until we're sure. Can we get another work crew, a dozen guys or so?"
"Sure, I guess so," Stu said. "What for?"
"A turning off crew. Just a bunch of guys to go around Boulder and turn off everything that was left on. We don't dare turn the juice back on until that gets done."
"We got no fire department, man."
Brad laughed a little crazily.
"We're having a free zone committee meeting tomorrow night," Stu said. "You come on over and explain why you want them, and we'll get your men. But are you sure that overload won't happen again?"
"Pretty damn sure, yeah. It wouldn't have happened today if there hadn't been so much stuff left on. Speaking of that, somebody ought to go over to North Boulder and see if it's burning down."
Nobody was sure if Brad was joking or not. As it turned out, there were several small fires, mostly from hot appliances. None of them spread in the drizzle that was falling. And what people in the zone remembered later about the 1st of September 1990 was that it was the day the power came back on, if only for 30 seconds or so. An hour later, Fran pedaled her bike into Eben G. Fine Park across from Harold's. At the park's north end, just beyond the picnic tables, Boulder Stream chuckled mildly along. The morning's drizzly rain was turning into a fine mist. She looked around for Larry, didn't see him, and parked her bike. She walked through the dewy grass toward the swings, and a voice said, "Over here, Franny." Startled, she looked toward the building that housed the men's and women's toilets and felt a moment of utter confused fear. A tall figure was standing in the shadows of the short passageway running through the center of the dual comfort station.
and for just a moment, she thought. Then the figure stepped out, and it was Larry, dressed in faded jeans and a khaki shirt. Fran relaxed.
"Did I scare you?" he asked.
"You did, just a little." She sat down in one of the swings, the thud of her heart beginning to slow. "I just saw a shape standing there in the dark.
I'm sorry, I thought it might be safer, even though there's no direct line of sight from here to Harold's place.
I see you rode a bicycle, too."
She nodded.
"Quieter."
"I stowed mine out of sight in that shelter."
He nodded to an open-walled, low-roofed building by the playground. Franny trundled her bike between the swings and the slide and into the shelter. The odor inside was musty and fetid. The place had been a make-out spot for kids too young or too stoned to drive, she guessed. It was littered with beer bottles and cigarette ends. There was a crumpled pair of panties in the far corner and the remains of a small fire in the near one. She parked her bike next to Larry's and came back outside quickly. In those shadows, with the scent of that long-dead sex musk in her nose, it was too easy to imagine the dark man standing just behind her, his twisted coat hanger in hand.
"Regular Holiday Inn, isn't it?" Larry said dryly.
"Not my idea of pleasant accommodations," Fran said with a little shiver. "No matter what comes of this, Larry, I want to tell Stu everything tonight."
Larry nodded.
"Yeah, and not just because he's on the committee. He's also the marshal."
Fran looked at him, troubled. Really, for the first time, she understood that this expedition might end with Harold in jail. They were going to sneak into his house without a warrant or anything and poke around.
"Oh, bad," she said.
"Not too good, is it?" he agreed.
"You want to call it off?"
She thought for a long time and then shook her head.
"Good. I think we ought to know one way or the other."
"Are you sure they're both gone?"
"Yes. I saw Harold driving one of the burial committee trucks early this morning, and all the people who were on the power committee were invited over for the tryout."
"You sure she went?"
"It would look damn funny if she didn't, wouldn't it?"
Fran thought that over, then nodded.
"I guess it would. By the way, Stu said they hope to have most of the town electrified again by the 6th.
"That's going to be a mighty day," Larry said, and thought how nice it would be to sit down in Shannon's or the Broken Drum with a big Fender guitar and an even bigger amp and play something, anything, as long as it was simple and had a heavy beat, at full volume. Gloria, maybe, or Walkin' the Dog. Just about anything, in fact, except, Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?
"Maybe," Fran said, "we ought to have a cover story, though, just in case."
Larry grinned crookedly. "Want to say we're selling magazine subscriptions if one of them comes back?"
"Har, har, Larry."
"Well, we could say we came to tell her what you just told me about getting the juice turned on again. If she's there."
Fran nodded.
"Yes, that might be okay."
"Don't kid yourself, Fran. She'd be suspicious if we told her we'd come up because Jesus Christ just appeared and is walking back and forth on top of the city reservoir."
"If she's guilty of something."
"Yes, if she's guilty of something."
"Come on," Fran said after a moment's thought. "Let's go."
There was no need for the cover story. Steady, hard rapping, at first the front and then the back door, convinced them that Harold's house was indeed empty. It was just as well, Fran thought. The more she thought about the cover they'd worked out, the thinner it seemed.
"How did you get in?" Larry asked.
"The cellar window." They went around to the side of the house, and Larry pulled and tugged fruitlessly at the window while Fran kept watch.
"Maybe you did," he said, "but it's locked now."
"No, it's just sticking. Let me try."
But she had no better luck. Sometime between her first clandestine trip out here and now, Harold had locked up tight.
"What do we do now?" she asked him.
"Let's break it."
"Larry, he'll see it."
"Let him. If he doesn't have anything to hide, he'll think it was just a couple of kids breaking windows in empty houses. It sure looks empty with all the shades pulled down. And if he does have something to hide, it'll worry him plenty, and he deserves to be worried. Right?"
She looked doubtful, but didn't stop him as he took off his shirt, wrapped it around his fist and forearm, and crunched the basement window. Glass tinkled inward, and he felt around for the catch.
"Here 'tis."
He released it, and the window slid back. Larry slipped through and turned it to help her. "Be careful, kiddo. No miscarriages in Harold Lauder's basement, please." He caught her under the arms and eased her down. They looked around the rumpus room together. The croak